So welcome everyone. My name is Anna Marie Pinder. I am the AVP of Marketing and Communications for the National Pork Producers Council. We also go by NPPC for short. Thank you for joining us today for our media roundtable to discuss California Proposition 12 and where NPPC and the American Farm Bureau Federation will present oral arguments to the U.S. Supreme Court next month. We have a nice mix of folks, both in person and virtual today, spanning a range of media.
Recording in progress.
And before I hand this program off to Terry Walters, our NPPC's board president, I want to mention just a couple of housekeeping things. As you just heard, for transparency, we will be recording today's discussion. For those online, please mute yourself unless you're speaking, and to raise the hand feature if you have a question. And unless anyone has any questions, I'm going to go ahead and pass the baton over to Terry for some remarks.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate you taking time to be here with us today. Happy to host both attendees in person and virtually. We'll do our best to recognize everyone throughout both areas and do our best to try and accommodate the questions from the virtual participants. As I said, as Anne Marie said, my name is Terry Walters. I'm your current president for NPPC, pig farmer from Minnesota, where we would be the number two largest pork production state in the country. This afternoon, I'm joined by fellow officers, Scott Hayes, our president-elect from Missouri, and Lori Stevemer, our vice president from Minnesota as well. Along with our officer team here, we have we're joined by our CEO, Brian Humphreys, and various members of our subject matter experts that might be relevant to today's discussion. We're happy to be back in Washington, D.C. In person. It's the second time this year, and we're happy to host the roundtable to interact with those of you in the media. For those of you that don't know or are not as familiar with NPPC, allow me to share a few points. NPPC advocates on behalf of social, environmental, and economic sustainability for over 66,000 pork producers and partners fighting for reasonable public policy, defending our freedom to operate, and expanding our global markets. Our vision in the industry is not just a way of life. It is that we continue to have a viable industry for the next generation of producers for us to follow us. It's been quite a year in U.S. agriculture. While our industry has faced many challenges, we've had evolving dynamics in the pig industry, the pig farmers of today have worked with unprecedented environment. We are facing large labor shortages. The disease threat to our domestic herd has never been greater, along with the challenging trade environment that has existed for the last several years. We're dealing with record high grain prices, rising energy costs, inflation is adding to our business in many different fronts. Meanwhile, there is a backdrop of a new pending legislation that could threaten the farmers' ability to effectively care for their animals and challenge this way of living, not to mention impact the consumer and the pork supply chain. That's why we are here in Washington, D.C., participating in our country's democratic process. We've met with many legislators on the Hill. We were represented by over 100 farmers across the country that have been here to meet with their congressional staff. All of us here share a passion of the industry. We work hard at raising healthy pigs, healthy animals, and provide a safe, wholesome supply of pork, not only to the consumers here in the United States, but around the globe. That's why you're invited here today to hear our perspectives on some key issues that impact both myself and my fellow producers. I'd like to give you the opportunity to ask questions throughout this program into a deeper dive into some of these subjects. For the moment, I'd ask you to write down October 11th of 2022. This date is an impactful date, not only to the U.S. pork industry, but also to states across the country, as it sets the precedent for states to regulate or not regulate what goes on outside their borders. We feel this is an unconstitutional overreach that will impact future generations of pig farmers and pork production, along with consumer impacts that we'll talk about later. Of course, I'm speaking about the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll hear California Proposition 12, as it violates, like I mentioned, what we believe our U.S. Constitution. This case is top of mind for many producers. We support our producers' ability to make decisions in the best interest of our animals, or it has the potential to impact and disrupt the supply chain, rising food costs to consumers, and threaten animal health and farm sustainability. Today, my fellow officers are joined by Michael Formica, NPPC's legal strategist, along with Travis Cushman, who is a deputy general counsel for American Farm Bureau Federation. While we share a few opening statements around before the roundtable, for those that are virtual, please use the chat line to ask your questions, and the moderator will introduce the appropriate people as we speak. Along with those that are participating in the room, we'll try and acknowledge who we are so those online can understand who's talking. Michael, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Terry. We had filed this challenge to Proposition 12, a ballot initiative that California voters passed in 2018, nearly 3.5 years ago. We filed it in late 2019. Our feeling then and continues today is that if any law is unconstitutional and violates the Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, Proposition 12 is unconstitutional. It reaches thousands of miles outside of the state of California, imposes very prescriptive standards on farmers who have no contact with the state of California, will force them to incur millions of dollars in renovations to their farms, to have to host inspectors from the state of California to their farm to come visit them. And at the same time, while being in the name of improving animal welfare, ironically, will significantly decrease the welfare and the health and the safety of those animals that is in the care of the farmer. It is incredibly disruptive to the industry. And as Terry has pointed out, will be very disruptive to the food supply chain. And I will turn over to Travis.
Thank you, Michael. This is Travis Cushman with the American Farm Bureau Federation. First off, I want to thank Michael Formica for his leadership on this issue. Both opportunity to work with Brian Humphreys and Scott Hayes. They've been tremendous partners to American Farm Bureau, and we've really enjoyed working together. This issue goes well beyond the pork industry. This is an issue that could face farmers everywhere in all types of farming activities. And, you know, while we obviously share California's goal of ensuring animals are well cared for, unfortunately, this does not let farmers have a say in that. And for me, what this really comes down to is the small farmer who'll be unable to spend millions of dollars to renovate his operation to satisfy a law in a state elsewhere that might change again in a few years. So that, from the AFBF perspective, that is our biggest concern, what this will do with the small farmer.
Let's open it up now for questions.
Yeah. Spencer, since you're sitting right next to me, I'll let you kick it off.
I guess, Terry, I mean, we've heard from the two lawyers at the table, but interested in a producer perspective. I mean, if for the sake of argument, the Supreme Court does not side with you and Prop 12 remains, what does that mean for you as a producer, for your bottom line, et cetera?
So the one aspect I'd comment is on the sustainability carbon footprint push that this administration is making. Obviously, it's a top priority for the administration. The challenges in and around that are, as individual producers, the arbitrary housing standards of going to 24 square feet, that is, it's unscientific, it's not documented. But in order for me to comply with that, I've got to expand my gestation facilities approximately 20%. So not only is that an added cost that's going to be incurred by me as a producer, it's going to incur added electricity, propane costs, and those costs today are coming at a price tag of around $3,500 a sow space. Okay, that economic impact is not going to be able to be borne by many of the producers. Individually, you're going to, individually, producers are not going to be able to handle that at a small level, and therefore they'll end up with pushing small producers out of the business. Okay, with that, you're going to drive consolidation, which is a fear of mine. And I think the ultimate goal that will, or a problem that will come around, is the fact that the consumer will be borne those costs, right? Somebody's going to have to pay for that.
So I guess just as a follow-up then, you know, you're talking about the, you know, $3,500 per sow space expansion. I guess my question is, why pay all that money to do the expansion? Why not just tell California to get their bacon elsewhere?
Well, along that line, they're a large market. They're 15% of our U.S. market. And so from this perspective, I don't know that we can ignore them. What I'd prefer to see happen is the proposition not be passed and let consumers make a choice. If consumers want to buy loose house sows, they will pay for that product. Let the producers and the veterinarians decide what's best for the animals. Let the consumer decide what they like to pay for.
And one thing I would add is, you know, from the farmer's perspective, we don't decide where meat is sold eventually. We don't dictate that, but this will require inevitably integrators and the other meat packers to tell us what to do. So we're not going to make that decision at our level.
If Mark Heller at E&E News, if I could ask an elementary question, because I honestly just don't know. Let's say I'm a producer and I'm raising hogs on a contract basis. I don't actually own those hogs. Does the company that I'm under contract with bear any responsibility, or should they, for improvements that I need to make on my farm? Is that written in the contracts at all?
I'm not aware that's written in the contracts, but I also would have a question about your question of a contract grower, right? Many segments of the producer involve contract growers. This is primarily a gestation farrowing regulation. Okay. Not as many of those herds are under contract production. They're more primarily owned by producers.
Right. Okay.
But I would also say, like, we raise pigs for another family and we finish them. So if that other family that's that we raise for is not able to sell pork into California, they might not need us as contract growers, right? So that could force us out of a business, even though we don't even own sows.
Right.
Okay. Spencer, if I could go back to your question. I'm Scott Hayes, a pig farmer from Northeast Missouri, and I'm fifth generation on the farm raising pigs. And so I'd just like to express our family's frustration with this. You know, we've spent well over a century raising pigs on the same farm. And I vividly remember conversations with my dad and grandpa about pigs and how we can raise them better, how we can make their life better. It's just known in our family. If the pigs do well, we do well. It was even at one point, my dad and grandpa built some feeding stalls in dirt lots when pigs were outside because of the aggressive behavior of pigs, especially around feeding time. It didn't work, but they tried. So we're very frustrated about the animal welfare part of this thing. You know, we, like I said, we're five generations deep in raising pigs, and now we have some folks that know nothing about raising pigs or very little about raising pigs coming to our farm and telling us how it should be done. We've done it that way because that's the only way we could do it 50, 60 years ago. It doesn't work. And so we're very frustrated. We feel like we're going backwards. And animal care. It's just, I hope you understand our frustration because it's not the way we want to take care of animals.
Yeah, this is Lori. Stephen Martieri touched a little bit on the sustainability and also economics. And I just want to add with those economics, if implementing the regulations for Proposition 12 it will increase the cost of raising pigs. That will increase costs to the consumer, right? So pork prices will go up. I do a number of consumer events, state fair, health expo at Grandma's Marathon. People come up to me and tell me they like pork because it's versatile, because it's affordable. And certainly in these times of inflation and people already watching their food dollars, that's a big deal. So it affects consumers. And ultimately, if it costs more to raise pigs, I'm afraid that farmers are going to go out of business. As you alluded to, Travis, they just can't make those financial commitments.
And Mark, so Terry mentioned sort of the cost, you know, the increased energy cost. But underlying that is the fact if you are building a barn now that is 20% larger, so it's 20% more concrete, 20% more steel, those are one-time, significant one-time costs. But then you have to operate that farm. And you're looking at every year, every winter, and it gets, been in Minnesota in the winter, it gets pretty cold. You have 20% or more space that you need to heat. You don't get the benefit of the animals, you know, generating their own body heat. So you're going to have to generate warmth for that area that is not being used by the animals. And so you might as well be, you know, you're just burning energy for no reason. During the summer, if it's warm out, you have to run fans. You've got to cool that same space down. It's one thing to cool the space where the animals are living down, but now we have 20% more space that's not being used that also needs to be cooled down.
So how much, what's the analysis on the price impact consumers if this were implemented all the way through, I guess? And then just refresh my memory, what was the final ruling? I guess it had been Ninth Circuit. What was the outcome on that?
Let me talk about the Ninth Circuit, and sure, then you can talk about the cost. So the Ninth Circuit ruled. The Ninth Circuit found that we had pled a very plausible case going forward. That you know we had producers, we had experts, we absolutely documented how Proposition 12 was going to have significant impact on the industry. The problem in the Ninth Circuit is that the law, the precedent within the Ninth Circuit would not allow a case like this to go forward. And so the Ninth Circuit law, as it often is at odds with how that analysis would be conducted elsewhere in the country. If you were in the Seventh Circuit, there is precedent that is in direct conflict with the Ninth Circuit. Most pigs are, you know, a huge share of pigs. I should say most pigs. I was in the Eighth Circuit, but a large percentage of pigs happen to reside in the Seventh Circuit. The law there wouldn't allow Proposition 12 to stand. There are not very many pigs in California, but yet the Ninth Circuit precedent would allow it to stand. So when you have that conflict, that's ripe for a Supreme Court review.
And I would just say, this is Laura again, in terms of food prices, I mean, just with inflation, we've seen overall food prices go up about 11%. I think pork's been up probably 6 to 7%. Certainly if we want a more exact value for that, I would lean towards Holly Cook, our economist, to get you that information.
Yeah. We have estimates of that, but you know, it's tough to, you know, it's tough to calculate until the law is actually in effect. You know, just the hours before our brief was filed, we received notice from California that they had finally over three years late finalized their rules implementing Proposition 12. That's great. There is an injunction in place against their their enforcement of those rules on the pork side, and so we don't really know what the real impact is going to be, but certainly our economists have looked at this. We talked about again the energy use. You're going to have animals up and moving around. There's going to be increased feed costs in these Proposition 12 farms. All those costs will get passed on portion of, you know, will get passed on and carry with the cost of that pig. But there's only one pig, and that one pig becomes many different cuts of meat. And so maybe the bacon goes to California, but the ribs might end up, you know, in my, you know, in my house in Virginia, and they're not going to carry the cost of I'm not going to pay the cost of Proposition 12. The hams are going to get exported down to Mexico, and the Mexicans aren't going to pay for that added cost of Proposition 12. Variety meats, other, you know, pieces of the pig, the pig will be exported. Our export partners aren't going to pay for that. And ultimately, that's a cost that the farmers are going to have to bear.
Just wanted to see, this has been a good conversation. Does anyone online would like to pose any questions? Raise your hand.
I guess while that's queuing up, just a technical question, Michael. Is your challenge Prop 12 generally, or just the interstate commerce provisions?
Our challenge is limited to the pork provisions, the Proposition 12. So it'll have no bearing on the egg or on the veal provisions. And California is free to regulate hog farms that are located in California. And so to the extent they want Proposition 12 to apply to those hog farms, that's well within their authority to do so. Our concern is when they reach out into Iowa or into Minnesota or to Missouri and try and tell farmers there what to do.
And Michael, if I might add to that, that's my concern as a producer, is that California is going to set this standard if it's upheld. Then is Oregon going to pick a different plan? Is Washington going to pick a different method? How are we as producers supposed to respond to all different states and potential propositions or regulations? We've got one operation, one pig, to Michael's earlier comment, that we're trying to deal with. And I don't know that we as producers are going to be able to accommodate everybody's individual state standard as we operate our operations.
And just to build off that a little bit more and bring things slightly outside of agriculture, California's attorney during oral arguments in a similar case acknowledged that under California's logic here, they'd be able to regulate wages in other states. They would say that you can't sell your widget, your computer in our state unless it was built according to our, you know, standards of what appropriate wage would be.
Michaela, if you'd like to, Jackie with Farm Progress has a question. Jackie, welcome you to unmute yourself and pose the question to the panel.
Thanks for the time today. I just wanted to get your insight. You've talked a lot about the economic impacts. Do you feel like your case rests more on the economic impact to the consumers, producers, or is it within the Commerce Clause challenge of the restrictions, what California actually established that could impact commerce across all state lines?
So at this point, our claims are presumed true. We were, not to get too technical, but our case was dismissed before we were able to have that factual debate of economic consequences. So at this point, the court has to presume that all of our assertions as the economics are true. So this will really boil down at this point to the legal claim on the Commerce Clause.
I have kind of a follow-up question on the producer side. So there are some companies that have said that they are already in compliance or that they could be in compliance really quickly to supply the California market. But obviously this is maybe like a numbers game. And as a producer, can you talk a little bit about how, like, would you just end up not supplying the California market? Are the companies that are saying they could supply that market, could they actually supply that 15%? Or is this like, it really would be broader than those companies that are already saying they're compliant?
I can take a shot at that, but I think to our earlier comments, right? Individual producers are going to make individual choices. And so depending upon where I market to as a producer, I might have a different decision process. But the companies that are larger, they're going to be able to withstand the cost changes, could be some of the companies you're referring to, right? So with that concern, you're going to drive consolidation, which is against what this administration in particular has been speaking against, right? So I'm concerned about individual independent family farmers, which is what keeps rural America alive. And that's what we have to be concerned about from that perspective, because the consolidation is a real deal and it'll be the large companies that have the financial wherewithal to do it.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I would just add that it's free enterprise, right? If I'm a company that decides I want to supply a niche market or a certain market for pork, let's say, and I go back and say, producers, if you're going to raise pork for our company and sell to us, I'll give you X dollars more. I mean, that's free enterprise, right? I'm responding to a market demand. Mm-hmm. We've done that over and over again in the pork industry. We were told to be leaner in the 80s. We got leaner. So that's free enterprise. That's different than just saying you have to do it and you don't get a seat at the table. So I think to your question, can there be enough? It all depends on how companies are able to respond through free enterprise, not just being forced and dictated.
Yeah. So some of the companies who are making those claims now are already producing that product because there was some demand out of it. And they're simply selling the product that is already there. That, you know, we estimate that's about 4 to 5% of the market. You know, it's one thing to go to, you know, the average Whole Foods consumer is, you know, a single woman, 30 years old, with a graduate degree, makes $80,000 a year. You know, if you take just the people living below the poverty line in California, right, that's the 21st largest state in the country. Mm-hmm. They are not Whole Foods shoppers, not single Whole Foods out. Right. And so there's a variety of consumers out there. They all have a right to eat. They all have a right to have access to food. They all have different needs and desires. And so, yeah, is there supply to meet some very specialized market segments? Certainly. Is there supply to meet the entirety of that market? I wonder.
Jackie online, you have another question? We actually have it from Katie. Sorry, okay, Katie. Sorry. Katie, if you want to unmute and ask a question.
Hi, thank you all for doing this today. I just wanted to clarify, I think you guys kind of talked about this a little bit before, but with California only representing about, you know, 13 to 15% of the US pork market, why is the NPPC arguing that California's law impacts all producers across the country? I mean, is it because the different parts of the pig go to a variety of places, or what's the reason that this impacts all producers?
Well, it's Terry, and I would say, you know, relative to me as a producer, I market to a packing company. And so how and where those products end up, I don't have any control over. So I think it is a situation that measured by 15% measured by volume is what California is going to represent. But many packers will then require us to deliver those products. And our concern is that not all the pieces of the pig are going to end up in California. If they only want one part of the pig, one primal cut, then the cost has to be borne across the whole pig.
This is Brian Humphreys, and with NPPC, it's also probably important to point out for folks who may not be aware that the state of California, there aren't enough pig producers in the state of California to supply the product that they consume. And so therefore, the brunt of this law is impacted on producers outside, because the pork products are coming into the state from outside the state of California. And so that's one of the reasons that NPPC got involved, is it is not specifically impacting just the producers, the pork producers in the state of California. It is impacting the producers that supply product to the packers that then supply product to the state of California, which to Terry's point could come from a multitude of states and does come from a multitude of states.
This is Michael with NPPC. This law was passed with the intention to regulate farmers who are located far outside of California. It takes about 750,000 to 1 million sows to satisfy the California market. If the pork from those sows, the piglets from those sows producing pork that only went to California, with the way the market's set up now, it's probably many, 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 many more times the number of sows. There are, according to USDA, about 8,000 sows in the state of California. The vast majority of those are show pigs. They are, you know, they will eventually become food, but they are not being raised for commercial food production purposes. There's about 1,500 sows, 1,500 sows in California on largely very small backyard type farms. Is simply insufficient to feed a state of 40 million people like California. And 15% of the market is a massive share of the market.
Katie, I might just add to that. That's to signal or help illustrate why the overreach is happening. Not only is it across the United States and all pork producers, but the country of Mexico and Canada also signed on to this case, because products that would come from outside the borders of the United States will be impacted by this rule as well.
So this is Michael again. There are a lot of sows in Canada which produce feeder pigs that come down south and are purchased by independent, you know, independent family farmers who want to take ownership of those pigs. They're not, you know, they're not raising them on a contract for a Canadian company. They're buying pigs that they own outright and then want to have the freedom to market to whatever, you know, whatever packer they can. Those pigs will also be subjected to Proposition 12. And those producers who will be unable to, you know, to guarantee what conditions the sows at birth their livestock were kept in are going to see a loss 15%, you know, 15% of the pork market. It's probably a larger share of the packing space that they can access.
Yeah, just real quick, Jackie has had her hand raised. So Jackie, we're going to give it back to you. You want to ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, more on the court case. MPPC and AFBF filed their court documents last week, if I remember correctly. What's the timeline for those on the other side to do their filing, and any issues that you've seen within those documents, or was it kind of as expected?
So this is Travis of AFBF. We filed our opening briefs in June. The other side, HSUS and California, filed their briefs in August. Our reply brief is what was filed last week. So that's the last round of briefs that will be filed in this case. And of course, with oral arguments on October 11th.
Did they also file reply briefs at the same time? Or do they still have time to reply to your reply briefs?
So the structure is, there's an opening brief, their response brief, and then we have a final reply brief. So there's nothing else after the reply.
They get to respond to what we say, and then we get to reply to what they respond. So, and then the court, you know, then the court decides.
Thanks, guys.
Philip, thank you.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions. One, just in terms of informational question, in terms of the structure of the cell production, how much of it is controlled by integrators? How much by very large? Because some of these other operations are pretty large. Can you give me an idea of what, first of all, how much of it's controlled by Smithville and other integrators? And that's the first question. Second question is, if you could just walk us through when you expect a decision from the court, and if that's advert at first, what would happen then from the industries?
I'm going to answer your second question first, and then I don't know if someone else who, you know, if Holly's on, who's our staff economist, can talk to the shares of the industry. So the court is under no, you know, so we'll have our case heard morning of October 11th. The court is under no deadline. They can do what they want. Realistically, they have until next June to issue a final ruling when the term ends. I suspect we will probably get a final decision in late January, February timeframe, maybe March timeframe, just based on the time, you know, when we're being heard in the calendar, the time it takes for them to hear these. If there's an adverse decision, that is that if we were to lose, that would be very unfortunate. But you know, that would be at this point, that would be the end of our challenge to Proposition 12 as it stands. Like I said, the regulations implementing Proposition 12 only came out last week, earlier this month. We were provided a couple of hours notice before our brief was filed. We're still reviewing those, and whether there's challenges to those or not remains to be seen. Though the Proposition 12's implementation is currently subject to an injunction in California, that injunction will be in place until March 1st, I believe. Time will tell.
Is that in a state court? State?
That was the Sacramento Superior Court. So
okay.
the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, yep. the California Restaurant Association, Grocers, I think the Latino Restaurant Association, California Retailers, they filed a challenge to the failure, essentially the failure of California to promulgate regulations in a timely manner. How can they comply with something when the rules are going to tell them how to comply aren't out there?
On those rules, I just have a clarifying question. I know those came out recently. Can you kind of walk us through if there were any like surprises in the implementation rules and what, if any, impact they might have on the case itself?
I don't know that there's any surprises in the rules. And this is Michael again. There are some areas where we had asked them for some more clarification, especially with regards to the stand up turnaround provisions. Some of the technologies that producers are looking at to comply with Proposition 12, it would be great if the rules made clear that those solutions actually were solutions. We have some questions about the timing. It looks like California has delayed the requirement for farms to be certified until January 1 of 2024. But yet Proposition 12 goes into effect immediately.
Okay.
What does that mean? So from the retailer's perspective, if the permits that California is going to require aren't required for 2 years, then how do they comply with the law in that 2 year period? And how does a grocery store of the pork that they're selling? How does a producer who's trying to produce pork for that market, how do you even get your farm inspected to be permitted to sell pork into that market when California is going to take a year and a half to approve the inspectors that are going to be trampling all around the country and visiting your farms?
And this is Travis, the AFBF. One thing the final regs did do is they did confirm that to be compliant to Prop 12, California will be sending inspectors unannounced onto farms across the country.
So that might be a dumb question, but why haven't you been able to get a political resolution? Why has there been a vehicle bill in Congress to say, California can't do this stuff?
We looked at political solutions in California initially, and Proposition 12 was drafted in a way which probably is unconstitutional. There's actually been some court cases going up through where other ballot initiatives drafted like it were declared unconstitutional, it requires 80% of both houses of the California legislature to vote to overturn it in order to have it be overturned. And you know, you can't get 80% of any legislative body to, you know, to agree on what day of the week it is, let alone you know, overturn, you know, a ballot initiative or a, you know, within at the federal level.
Yeah, there used to be a, you know, kind of insane congressman from Iowa who he pushed this issue in every farm bill that there, you know, we all called it the King Amendment. It just never seems to quite get the traction, even with this situation going on now. Got no answer.
I got nothing for you. My toolbox, you know, I work in the courts. I'll defer to the, you know, the Hill people for how Congress operates. But I'd suggest that Congress doesn't work as efficiently as we would hope it would all the time.
I have another question.
Anyone else have other thoughts on Congress?
I don't have any thoughts on Congress. I was just going to ask a question. I was just wondering, so there are some other states that have similar laws, but not exactly the same, although they're limited to producers in those states. Can you talk a little bit about how much overlap there is? Because one of the things I've been thinking about as we've been having this conversation is like, maybe there are already some producers in those states that are compliant. How much of the market does that impact? And also, you know, because I know, Terry, you brought up one of the issues is like, well, what if the law changes in 5 years or something? So is there any kind of consistency across states on this? What does that look like? And
that's a great question.
Thank you.
let me tell you how this plays out. We actually have two states that have passed, Ohio by regulation and Michigan by, you know, by statute. Have requirements on sow housing. They apply only post confirmation of pregnancy. So which Proposition 12 doesn't. They specifically allow for that period after the piglets have been weaned off the sow, and then, you know, through her recovery and until you have confirmed she is pregnant again, the use of breeding pens for the protection. You know, the state legislature, the regulatory bodies looked at this, you know, specifically allowed the use of the pens because it is so clearly in the interest of the sows. And so if you're a producer in Ohio or in Michigan, and you have spent millions of dollars now to comply with Ohio or Michigan law, which was negotiated with the Humane Society, you are not able to sell into California and completely prohibited and in violation of Proposition 12. And so that's sort of the way, to Terry's concern, how their strategy has been. They'll pass a law in one state, then they go to another state and it's slightly different. And, you know, that California's at 24 square feet. What if, you know, Oregon goes to 25 square feet? Or what if, you know, what's there to stop California from going to 30 square feet? You know, in the next election, or, you know, Massachusetts from passing another law that's at, you know, 35 square feet.
But the regulations in Ohio and Michigan only affect sows in Ohio or Michigan.
That's right.
And farmers are at the table when those regulations were made. So the difference is California's regulations affect, like we said, sows in other states. And we don't have a part of those regulations.
And there are, for all practical purposes, no sows in California.
Is anyone online or?
Did you have questions? Any information on the data on the
Holly
on the number of sow
production?
I can take that one. So about 6.2 million sows in the country, and to the specific companies that you'd have to, again, sorry for everyone online. This was Brian Humphreys with NPPC. About 6.2 million sows in the country. And there's breakdowns on the number of sows per company out there.
I think the bigger question before us today is not how this is going to, how many sows each company has, but the cost to them to be able to put this together. And at $3,500 a sow space, whether it's a large company or a small company, the impact is the same. The difference is the ability and lending ability, a borrowing capacity of a smaller producer that maybe has a few hundred sows or a couple thousand sows to be able to build that facility and put it together. So answer your question about 6.2 million sows. I believe the 2017 ag census, independent producers made up about 23% of the total inventory. So I'll give you an idea where we stand there.
And that's domestic. So that doesn't
domestic. That's not,
that doesn't include Canada, you know, the feeder pigs that are coming down from Canada.
Yep. And to Michael's earlier point, to give you a perspective of 6.2 million sows, approximately would take approximately 750,000 to a million sows to meet the California market at 15%, assuming that every pig born to those sows was traced all the way through the system and only delivered to the state of California. The reality is, to our previous conversation, that's not how the system, how consumers want. So,
last call for questions. You know, if you do have any follow-up questions, you can email them to news@mppc.org. Also, MPPC has Joe Cruz. Cruz just spoke up, and he does have a question. So, Joel, if you'd like to unmute and ask your question.
Yeah, just real quick. Sorry to be a straggler, but if I was just curious about like the scope of the compliance requirements. If the regulations were to go into effect, say first quarter of next year, what would that only apply to newly born pigs, or would that go back? I mean, what about the pork that's already in the pipeline? I guess is what I'm asking about.
This is Mike at NPPC. That is a great question, and to your question, one of the areas that we are unclear about, when California was as they were drafting their regulations, and we were coming up on the initial January 1 implementation date prior to the court imposing an injunction, California had taken the position that it would only apply to piglets that were born after that date. So a piglet born before January 1st wouldn't be covered by it. Piglets born after January 1 would be covered by Prop 12. We're not sure yet with the final regulations how exactly they will be implemented, and whether it applies to pigs that are born before or after September 1 of 2022, or if it would be before or after March 1st of 2023.
Thank you.
Last call. Thanks for everybody's questions. That's been a really good discussion. So if there's anything else, like I said, you can follow up sending us an email to news@mppc.org. We also have made live a California Prop 12 resource page on MPPC's website. So if you look, we'll circle back and send the link around. But if you go to our website at mppc.org, under the issues tab, the drop down, you'll see California Prop 12. And it has background information, the timeline of leading up to the oral arguments for next month, our legal filings, and other interesting articles and things that have been run on this issue. So thank you for coming, and we look forward to continuing this conversation. Thank you.